It is Thursday, August 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump and Moscow agree that relations between the United States and Russia are at a low point following Washington's imposition of new sanctions.
Look, the reason that Congress passed this bill, which is now law, is because they don't trust Donald Trump on Russia.
President Trump wants to change legal immigration to the U.S., and we hear why a classic story about a little girl who lives at New York's Plaza Hotel continues to delight fans. It's all ahead. U.S. President Donald Trump blamed Congress Thursday for creating new tensions with Russia by approving sanctions against Moscow. Trump took to Twitter to say our relationship with Russia is at an all-time and very dangerous low. He said Congress was to blame and chastise members for failing to support his effort to dismantle the country's health care law championed by his predecessor, former President Barack Obama. Olga Oleker is the director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I asked her for her opinion on the current relationship between Washington and Moscow.
The relationship is definitely at a low point. I still think the Cuban Missile Crisis was worse, though I suppose one could argue that was with the Soviet Union as opposed to the Russian Federation. But no, this is definitely a very, very challenging point in the relationship between the two countries.
Well, in this situation, you know, Congress overwhelmingly voted for the sanctions, and Trump, he did not want to risk having lawmakers override a veto. He went ahead and signed it, but he certainly made his displeasure with it very evident. This comes as amid his administration is being investigated for ties during his presidential campaign, the Trump presidential campaign in 2016, for ties to the Russians. You know, this also seems to add a sort of another dimension that I don't know that we've quite seen in previous White Houses.
Yeah, I think the allegations of collusion with a foreign government are comparatively new, at least in most people's memory. Look, the reason that Congress passed this bill, which is now law, is because they don't trust Donald Trump on Russia. They don't trust Donald Trump on Russia for a lot of reasons. One is that his own statements have indicated, you know, an interest in lifting at least some of the sanctions that have been imposed, particularly the ones imposed over Russian election interference. I think the Trump administration has not really spoken about lifting the sanctions that are linked to Minsk, and indeed from the State Department, we've heard the opposite. But it's an awkward, you know, to put it mildly, situation. I mean, this is an election that he won. With the allegations that the finding of the U.S. intelligence community is that the Russians interfered to help him, or at least to hurt Hillary Clinton. Now, you know, I don't think anyone has made a judgment that suggests that the intelligence community hasn't said that's why Donald Trump won, and I think most people would argue that's not why Donald Trump won. But, you know, it's certainly, even if he did not collude, right, the idea is that he should still be as angry over the interference, and the question is, well, is he if the interference helped him or was intended to help him?
Well, in his own series of tweets, a lot seems to be done on Twitter nowadays, but Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev said Trump's signing of the package of new Russia sanctions ends hopes for improving our relations. Well, from a Russian perspective in Moscow, how might Mr. Medvedev and Mr. Putin, you know, look at this to try to put their own spin, their own PR view on this?
Look, sanctions as a whole have costs and benefits for Russia. The benefit from the start, from 2014, from the start of the Ukraine crisis, Russia has been able to use the sanctions as something to point to for all of its economic problems at home, which really have had far more to do with, on the one hand, lower oil prices, though they're on their way back up. They're certainly not at the heights they were some years ago, and just a failure to reform the economy when the economy was booming, such that Russia could withstand shocks better. U.S. sanctions have very little to do with Russia's economic problems. European sanctions have a bit to do with them, and Russian counter-sanctions on Europe, where they banned a lot of agricultural goods from EU countries, hurt Russia and Russians far more. what the U.S., I mean, some of the U.S. sanctions, including new ones, will have an impact on the Russian energy sector. But, you know, overall, this doesn't change, the new legislation doesn't really change that much other than some of the investment in the energy sector. So you're looking at just a small uptick past the status quo, right? What the bill is doing is enshrining in law a lot of the sanctions imposed by, or all of the sanctions imposed by the Obama administration, making it very difficult for the Trump administration to lift the sanctions. So I think, you know, Russia isn't going to say, yay, wonderful, thank you, we love this, this is great. But I think for Russia, this underlines the difficulty of the relationship. But, you know, they knew that this was going to become law. They could also see the extremely wide majorities by which this legislation passed the House and the Senate. So they knew this was going to be law.
Olga Oleker, director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington, D.C. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
A lot of talk online about what President Trump is saying, which seems to be something that we could say any day of the week, really. But three things in particular today are drawing a lot of attention. The first is a release by the Washington Post newspaper of reported transcripts of President Trump's conversations with the leaders of Mexico and Australia when he spoke to them over the phone. And that gives a glimpse into President Trump's thinking and interactions, and also some surprises. And one in particular that people are talking about on social media, a phrase, local milk people. In a conversation with the Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, Trump says that he hates taking in refugees. They're bad people. He said they're not going to be wonderful people who go on to work for the local milk people. Lots of confusion about what that phrase means exactly. People saying that it means dairy farmers, confused as to why he didn't just say dairy farmers and said local milk people. So a lot of jokes at President Trump's expense with that phrase. That's the first instance people are talking about. The other two, the first of those, is he reportedly called the White House a dump during a golf outing. Now, that's something that the president has denied, saying he was misquoted in a golf publication that published this quote.
Yeah, I think he said it was fake news.
Yes, he said it was fake news, but he disputes that quote, saying it was inaccurate, that he did not say that. But lots of attention on that phrase. And then attention as well on the state of New Hampshire, of course, one of the states in the U.S. dealing with the opioid epidemic, lots of drug abuse there, and President Trump saying that New Hampshire is a drug-infested den. So not a lot of love for President Trump from people in New Hampshire. They don't like the fact that he referred to their state as such. So all of that being talked about today with President Trump, but also a lot of talk about Anthony Scaramucci, President Trump's short-lived communications director. He's looking to tell his story about his abrupt exit from the White House, and he's turning to one of his former boss's favorite channels, online media. Scaramucci's going to go online and have a video tomorrow, a live video, where he's going to talk about why he left the White House and what he plans afterwards, and give a glimpse into what was going on behind the scenes, maybe address some of the criticism that he received about some of the foul language that he used, but speaks volumes again about how wide social media and digital media reach and how much attention they get, that he's going not to television to do this, but going straight online. As the president has said multiple times, that's his direct channel to the people, and Anthony Scaramucci hopes it'll be his as well.
Yeah, very interesting development.
Yes, we'll see what he has to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending as we heard President Trump sparred with Mexican and Australian leaders in contentious phone calls. The U.S. will give an additional $169 million in aid to Ethiopia and Kenya. President Trump may boost pressure on China regarding trade and North Korea. And China joins a search for a missing U.S. sailor. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
On October 12th, a small asteroid, which NASA estimates is between 10 and 30 meters in size, will fly past Earth. Meanwhile, scientists led by Vishnu Reddy of the University of Arizona are planning to use the flyby for an observational campaign to test NASA's network of observatories and those who work with planetary defense. The tests will include preparedness drills, rehearsal of the various plans that will be needed concerning the threat of an asteroid impact. The space agency says it is certain that the space rock won't come any closer than 6,800 kilometers from Earth's surface, but will probably pass much farther away, perhaps 270,000 kilometers from us. Dr. Reddy says the purpose of the campaign is to find out just how prepared we are for the next cosmic threat. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear about a book from the 1950s about a little girl living in a New York City hotel that continues to delight fans. In a bid to fulfill a campaign pledge, President Donald Trump Wednesday announced his support of legislation backing a merit-based legal immigration system that emphasizes job skills, self-sufficiency, and English language proficiency.
The RAISE Act will reduce poverty, increase wages, and save taxpayers billions and billions of dollars. It will do this by changing the way the United States issues green cards to nationals from other countries. Green cards provide permanent residency, work authorization, and fast track to citizenship. For decades, the United States was operated and has operated a very low-skilled immigration system, issuing record numbers of green cards to low-wage immigrants. This policy has placed substantial pressure on American workers, taxpayers, and community resources. Among those hit the hardest in recent years have been immigrants and, very importantly, minority workers competing for jobs against brand new arrivals. And it has not been fair to our people, to our citizens, to our workers.
The legislation would reduce the issuance of green cards by half, from over 1 million to more than 500,000 a year. The administration called it the largest immigration reform proposal in 50 years. The bill's sponsors also propose to cap refugee admissions to 50,000 a year and end a visa diversity lottery that awarded 50,000 green cards a year. Critics warn the measure will curtail economic activity. Ira Melman is media director for the group Federation for American Immigration Reform, or FAIR. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the RAISE Act stems from recommendations of a presidential commission in the 1990s.
And they essentially came to the conclusion that we should significantly reduce immigration levels to about 500,000 a year, and that we should have a merit-based immigration policy that puts all applicants on equal footing, that when people come to the United States, they should be entitled to bring a spouse and unmarried minor children. But beyond that, we couldn't guarantee that the entire extended family would be allowed to come as well. A merit-based system means that we evaluate the various aspects of, you know, the people who want to come to the United States, and that would include their education, their job skills, their command of the English language, give preference to youth over elderly people. It would recognize essentially that the immigration policy is supposed to serve some identifiable public interests. Right now, we have an immigration policy that's based almost entirely on nepotism. Once you come to the United States, you can turn around and start petitioning for a whole range of extended relatives. You know, these relatives come with spouses who can then eventually petition for their extended families. We would look at people's individual qualifications and how they might fit into the needs of the country, rather than simply taking endless chains of family members.
There's a lot of controversy to this bill, and I'm just wondering if you think it has any chance of passing Congress.
Well, you know, it does have a chance if you have the leadership out there from Congress and also the White House making the case. You know, if you ask the American people if they think we should have an immigration policy that looks at people's individual merits rather than who they're related to in terms of determining who comes to the country, you would probably find across the board that people support an immigration action plan like that. The problem is that you've got entrenched special interests. You've got the ethnic interests that representing the dozen or so countries that absolutely dominate the immigration flow to the United States. And obviously, they want to preserve the status quo. And you have cheap labor interests that want to perpetuate an influx of large numbers of low-skilled workers into the United States, in spite of the fact that wages have been declining in those areas of the labor market for decades now.
Ira Millman said the U.S. stands to lose millions of jobs in the coming decade, many of them low-skilled positions to globalization and automation. The Pew Research Center recently discovered that over 40% of immigrants who arrived in the U.S. in the last 5 years held at least a college degree. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Eloise, the story of a six-year-old troublemaker who lives at the Plaza Hotel, is a beloved children's book, the first of a series of adventures of the precocious little girl. A show at the New York Historical Society looks at the creators of the series, author Kay Thompson, who died in 1998, and illustrator Hilary Knight, who's very much alive at 90. Jeff London reports.
For generations of children, Eloise is a favorite.
I'm Eloise. I'm six. I'm a city child. I live in the Plaza.
I met 10-year-old Annie Clark at the Plaza Hotel. She was dressed like Eloise in a black skirt, white shirt, pink sweater, and a red ribbon in her hair.
I think that I do kind of relate to her because she lives in New York City. I can be mischievous sometimes, but not always like her.
Eloise was the brainchild of the multi-talented Kay Thompson, born Kitty Fink in St. Louis, who at various points in her life was a radio personality, a vocal arranger at MGM, and a popular cabaret performer.
Kay Thompson, Kay Thompson.
Hello, hello. So much.
Thompson amused her friends with the voice of a little girl called Eloise, and one of those friends thought the character might make a good children's book. She lived next door to a young artist named Hilary Knight and introduced the two. Knight says he and Kay Thompson hit it off.
She was the most fantastic, interesting, funny, tough lady. She was incredibly talented, and I never had so much fun in my life.
They ended up working on four books together. Eloise has an absent mother, a close relationship with her nanny, her dog Weenie, her turtle Skipper D, and the staff of the Plaza Hotel, where she skibbles about and makes a lot of mischief. Jane Curley, the exhibition's curator, says Eloise became part of the cultural zeitgeist.
She landed at the Plaza in 1955 in the midst of the staid Eisenhower era, when role models for women were June Cleaver and Donna Reed, and all of a sudden, here's this wild, irrepressible six-year-old rushing around, barging into things, getting into trouble, and she struck a chord.
Eloise, Eloise, who is the little girl who lives at the Plaza in New York?
That's me, Eloise. I'm six. I live on the top floor.
Eloise struck such a chord that Curly says,
"The plaza was flooded with six-year-olds looking for Eloise, coming in and saying, 'Is Eloise here?'"
"Which they do to this day," says plaza concierge Hatsumi Komiali.
"And I also tell them to check the elevator. If the elevator comes down really, really slow, that means she did it again, that she pressed all the buttons."
Children visiting the plaza can have an Eloise tea in the palm court with pink cotton candy, go to a store with all kinds of Eloise merchandise, and even stay overnight in the Eloise suite on the 18th floor, designed by Betsy Johnson. It's a riot of pink, and each guest has a personal experience, says the plaza's PR director, Ariana Swerdlin.
"And whenever you come in, Eloise writes you a note."
The irony is that Kay Thompson never thought of Eloise as a children's book. Hillary Knight points out its subtitle is "A Book for Precocious Grown-Ups," about a little girl who lives at the Plaza Hotel.
"To her dying day, she said it was not a child's book. It offended her, you know, that people considered it that."
Curator Jane Curley agrees.
"She didn't like children very much, and she would waltz into Double Days and pick up stacks of her books out of the juvenile section and plunk them down in the grown-up section and then walk out."
The exhibition's centerpiece is a large portrait of Eloise that Knight painted for Thompson's birthday.
"There's Eloise standing there looking like English royalty."
Curley says the painting hasn't been displayed for 57 years. Thompson donated it to the plaza, where it hung in the lobby, but it was stolen on the night of the Junior League ball in 1960.
"Walter Cronkite announced on national TV, 'Eloise kidnapped from the Plaza Hotel.' Kay offered a reward. There was a great amount of excitement, but the portrait failed to show up."
2 years later, Knight got an anonymous phone call telling him the portrait was in a dumpster on the east side. He picked up the damaged painting and put it in storage, where it's been till it was restored for this exhibit. But the mystery remains. Who took it?
"I strongly suspect that this was Kay Thompson's best stunt ever. She was tired of Eloise. It was 1960. She'd taken the three books out of publication and only left the original book in publication. So to have the portrait disappear was a great exit."
But visitors to the New York Historical Society can enter the world of Eloise through October. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
That's our show. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has partnered with the United Nations Foundation's Girl Up campaign, Intel Corporation, Google, and other partners to lead the third annual Women in Science Girls STEAM Camp to enable girls to study the science, technology, engineering, arts and design, and mathematics fields. This year's two-week camp is taking place in Malawi, following a 2016 camp in Peru and a 2015 camp in Rwanda. Almost 100 high school girls from six African countries, Malawi, Rwanda, Uganda, Liberia, Tanzania, Zambia, and from the United States, have convened for a two-week program to increase their skills in the STEAM fields. In addition, the program is designed to increase the campers' leadership skills and networking opportunities. The curriculum includes coding, app development, engineering, robotics, micro and molecular biology, and satellite mapping. Throughout the duration of the camp, the girls will share their diverse, multicultural experiences and perspectives, forming friendships and connections that will help them to develop both personally and professionally. "It was my first time seeing a diverse group of girls who barely knew each other, empowering each other, not because they are best friends, but because they realize they have one common feature. They are all girls and want each other to be successful," wrote a young counselor from the 2015 Rwanda camp. The U.S. Department of State created the program to empower women and girls in the STEAM fields, help overcome the gender imbalance in those fields, and to prevent and respond to gender-based violence. The Department of State believes that education of women and girls, including expanding opportunities in science and technology, can help create a safer, more prosperous, and secure world by promoting economic growth and enabling women to drive innovation. During this time of rapid technological development, providing women and girls with access to high-tech resources, like-minded peers, impactful business connections, and inspiring mentors will empower young women to enter the STEAM fields. Women in both developing and developed countries represent tremendous promise for economic growth and prosperity, President Donald Trump recently said at a women's entrepreneurship finance event in Hamburg, Germany. When more women participate in the workforce, the world economy will grow, and millions of people will be lifted out of poverty. Empowering women is a core value that binds us together.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.